Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia. I'm the second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where family B2B brands go to grow. Today, I'm joined by Matt Cohen, president of Replenix. Matt leads an extraordinary 80-year-old family B2B business and represents the fourth generation of leadership. Replenix has built its reputation in industrial supply and distribution through decades of trusted supplier relationships, disciplined leadership, and the ability to adapt through market cycles that would test any business. What makes Matt's story especially compelling is that he stepped into leadership just as the 2008 market crash hit, forcing him to lead through one of the most uncertain economic periods in modern business history and certainly one of the most challenging periods for Replenix. Matt, welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Thanks, Ed. How are you today?
I'm awesome, man. It's great to talk with you today.
It's great talking with you, too.
So let's start with the family roots. What do you know about how your great-grandfather and grandfather first got Replenix off the ground after World War II, I believe it was?
It was after World War II. So if we, I know all the way back to the Great Depression.
Okay.
So during the Depression, companies like 3M and General Mills, big companies based in the Twin Cities, didn't have the cash to pay their employees their full pay in cash. So they chose to pay them in stock options as well, or actual stock. Mm-hmm. And my great-grandfather was a baker, and he had a choice. Do I let my neighbors starve, or do I help my neighbors out by accepting stock certificates in lieu of cash for bread? Hmm. Being the human that he was, he said, well, we'll accept the stock certificates. So now you file that, you know, in your memory, and then you fast forward to the Second World War. My grandfather was a corporal. He was stationed in New Jersey, and he was part of the Signal Corps.
Okay.
After the war was over, he came back to finish out his service here in the Twin Cities and was stationed at Fort Snelling, which was a local Army base here. Mm-hmm. And while at Fort Snelling, because he had an accounting degree and had experience with the numbers, he ended up getting assigned a project where he documented a huge cost savings at the time, you know, dollar-wise, for the Army. And he was proud of himself, rightfully so. He saved the federal government a whole bunch of money. And he got a thank you letter and looked at the letter and thought, there's got to be a better way to use my accounting skills and to get something better than a, gee, thanks. So when he was discharged from the Army, he had the ability to bid on surplus Army supplies.
Oh, okay.
And so my great-grandfather sold the 3M stock that he had received from his neighbors during the Depression to buy that first lot of Army surplus with my grandfather.
Hmm.
And they were grinding wheels, and they had no idea what grinding wheels did. And they put them in the trunk of their car, and they drove over to NAPCO, which was a local business that was owned by a friend of theirs. And they learned what the grinding wheels did. And then they found out who else buys grinding wheels. And that's how they started their business.
Mm, wow. That's amazing.
And then we went, and true entrepreneurship, right?
Yeah.
They got the ability to buy a product at a low cost, learned how that product creates value for customers,
mm-hmm.
and then found a whole bunch of other customers that they could bring value to. No different than my great grandfather saying, I sell bread and that is a value to people during the Great Depression, and I can give them bread in exchange for the share certificates. That whole idea of helping was, I think, instrumental in that part of launching the business, but is just part of who they were.
And having the entrepreneurial mindset to say, these items and the things that I can do may garner more value than a thank you note. Well, a thank you note's nice.
Hey, everybody appreciates a well-written thank you note. It's a lost art today, but I think when you're a corporal in the U.S. Army and you find a lot of money, an entrepreneur also thinks, well, maybe we should share.
So, thank you for sharing that. That's really a very interesting story, and probably not one unlike any that we've heard on this show to date. I want to get back to a previous discussion we were having before this program. You referenced, and I love the way you put it, the generational norms of a family-governed business. So the first generation starts, the second builds, the third breaks, and the fourth has the attitude of, as you put it, not on my watch. Talk to me about that. You're the fourth generation, so you're the not on my watch generation. So tell me a little bit about what that means to you.
I think really for me, it's about the legacy. You know, for me, it's so when I think about that, that common kind of way of describing generational businesses, I think part of what happens between Gen 1 and Gen 2 and then Gen 2 to Gen 3 is that by Gen 3, oftentimes it's the emphasis is on family and then business. That there's oftentimes multiple cousins and multiple siblings involved, and it is about making sure that the family, not necessarily a lifestyle business, but a business to fund a family. And my father and great grandfather had an opportunity to do something and grow another business. And so with this business, they hired outside family leaders. Who, so while my father was still involved with the decisions that went on here, the day-to-day was also managed by really trusted leaders. And that helped, I think, our organization keep the business a business and kind of staved off that whole piece of what a third generation encounters, which is family first, business second. And that really enabled me to think about what's the legacy here and refocus the business. When we talk about it internally, Replenix is a business owned by a family. We make business decisions that are good for our employees, that are good for our customers, that are good for our suppliers. And if we make those decisions putting the business first, then we get to a benefit for the family. And the not on my watch is just my little reminder that I am the shepherd of a legacy. It ultimately, whether my children or my brother's children decide to come to Replenix and bring that legacy to a fifth generation or not, or their spouses, because that would work too. I am shepherding a legacy, and it is my responsibility with my leadership team and all the people who are part of this Replenix team to make sure that we honor that legacy that got us to the 80 years.
Absolutely. And I love the way you stated that, really, especially for our listeners, that when you put the business first in the right way, it ultimately does bring the greatest benefit to the family, not the other way around. So I think that's a great point.
There's plenty of businesses that ultimately. Even in the second generation, even in a first generation, it's easy to get caught up in the family dynamic.
Certainly.
Arguably, you're having family dinners, you're celebrating holidays and milestones, and it becomes really easy, I think, to put family first. And early on in my career, I had the benefit of sitting down with somebody and really thinking about what it means to be a family business, and that there is that family piece and there's the business piece. What do you do as a business? And then there's an ownership piece that really talks about, you know, ownership structure and sales and shares and dividends and things like that. The sweet spot is where they all kind of intersect. But if you don't acknowledge that family is family and you have to keep your family traditions independent of the business, business is business. Just because somebody's a family member doesn't mean that they can show up to work late, not get their job done on time, or abuse PTO policies, all that kind of stuff. And you have to have an ownership structure that supports all of that. And that intersection ultimately, I think, drives the decisions around not on my watch.
Absolutely.
Keeping those things in balance and that three-legged stool on stable ground gives you the ability to create a legacy.
Absolutely. And it's a great thought process to share because, interestingly, we've had a couple of third generation leaders on the program, and they go in knowing that it's usually their generation that messes things up. So those that are good are especially mindful of that. Like, well, maybe not on my watch either.
Listen, I'd like to think that I was bright enough to be the one that says the first builds it, the second grows it, and the third breaks it. But I mean, you know, sometimes it's just good to have good resources to learn good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, when I was very young in the buyout of this business as a second gen, I was at a breakfast meeting, and there was a consultant who said, you know, I told him what I did and who I was. And he's like, you know, most businesses, you know, to the tune of 85% fail on the generational transfer.
Right.
I'm like, I really didn't need to hear that.
Knowing that,
I didn't need to hear that.
Knowing that just making it from Gen 1 to Gen 2 puts you in the top 15% should feel good, though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, for all of us who are in family-owned businesses or businesses owned by families that have made it through generational transfers, every time we do that, we are defying the odds. And, you know, ultimately, it's not to be disrespectful to the large corporations and the conglomerates and everything else. But you know, as businesses that are independently owned and operated and contributing to our local economies, I mean, there is a real value in being able to not only successfully make those leaps from Gen 1 to 2 and 2 to 3 and so on, but the ability to give back into your community just by being an independently owned and operated business that cares about the people and the customers and the supplier base. I think that that's really special.
Absolutely. And it's not uncommon to see amongst the ranks, and you maybe see it at Replenix, whereas, you know, the generational shifts have happened in your family. I wouldn't be surprised if there were some personnel on your team that maybe are representing the next generation of their family. As is often the case.
We have a mother-son relationship that exists in the building today. And we've had a couple in and out over the years. But yes, today we have a mother and a son who both work here.
That's really cool.
And I love it. I mean, it brings me joy when I see them carpool to work together or do things at lunch together. I mean, it is one of the special things about being able to create that culture and that legacy.
100%, 100%. So getting back to your journey for a minute, you didn't come straight into the president role or the operating side even. Your journey started with a law degree, and you entered the business as, I think your first title there was general counsel.
Yes.
So talk about that background, Nat, if you wouldn't, and how did that shape the way that you elected to govern and lead back then, you know, as you stepped into a leadership role, and maybe even how it shapes the way you lead to this day?
Well, I'm going to start with, my mom said he needs to go work for somebody else
and
spend time working outside of the business before he ever comes into the business, if he ever does. And at the time, I wasn't offended by it. I didn't necessarily understand it or appreciate it, but learning a different business and a different business model and a way to do things, I'll never be able to thank her enough for pushing me away from doing this until I had done something else that was esteeming, that I had learned and gotten, gotten my feet wet, so to speak. And the beauty of having gone to law school is, law school is as much about just a way of thinking about things and solving problems. And I think some of the best lawyers that I went to law school with, and ones that I've known through through my life, through business, some of the best practicing lawyers are just plain curious. And that curiosity, I think, was really helpful. And coming in and with that general counsel title, really, it didn't put it helped by not putting me at odds with any one person. I wasn't inheriting a seat. I didn't Nobody got fired because I came in to take their spot. I came in a capacity that was designed to understand how does this business really work. And to understand, at the time we had three different divisions, and we were in the process of contemplating the strategic role, was it rollout? It's not rollout. We were going to shed two different business units. That's a better way
Okay.
of saying it.
Divestiture.
Sell off
Okay.
and divestiture. Thank you. See, I've been not practicing law for so long. It's so long, I can't remember the words. We divested of two businesses, but again, learning how did those businesses fit in or not fit in anymore, and then how were we going to use the revenue from those sales to reinvest in the business. And so again, all of it was happening adjacent to the core part of what we do, which not only allowed me to be curious, but upset very few apple carts and allowed the business to run. I don't know if it was designed that way when my dad and the president put it together, but boy, did that was the impact.
And it's many, many of our guests, it's actually a family business mandate where you cannot step directly into a role with the family business. You have to go outside for some period of years, and it's I think that part is a little bit loose, but go do something else first and try something else and then decide, so that no one could ever say, well, you were kind of forced into this or goaded into this, or you had no other options, as a young person, which I think is a healthy, healthy practice.
Broadly speaking, I think that whether, because I've been doing this now for 24 years, whether it's the current generation or my generation or prior generations, there is something esteeming of knowing that you're not there just because, as a dear friend of mine likes to say, because you're Sato, son of the owner. And to know that you have earned your right to have a seat at the table, I think is really critical. And especially in a family business or a business owned by a family, I mean, arguably, that's where that delta really comes into play. In a family-owned business, whoever the junior is shows up and they start working after high school, after college, or whatever that time frame is, and it's a default mechanism. But then when you think about a business owned by a family, what are the credentials that somebody needs to have, even in an entry-level position, in order to be competitive and keep the business competitive? How do you make the business decision independent of family? And again, I'm eternally grateful to my mother for kind of setting that boundary, not just for me, but for my brothers. And while they never had an interest in the business, setting that boundary, I think it really set me up for success.
As a quick question, where were you in the hierarchy of your the pecking order of your siblings? Are you middle? Are you oldest?
Oh,
Youngest?
you can't tell from this conversation that I'm number one? I tell
I could
everybody I'm the
not.
oldest, I'm the smartest, I'm the best looking, and the most humble.
Ah, I could tell that. Yes,
Yes.
that's
So
probably the
I
case.
and my brothers both roll their eyes at the same time when I say it. I've got amazing brothers who are actually on most subjects way smarter than me. And not just because they chose to not be in a business owned by a family, but they're really great humans, and I owe a lot of my success here to how I've used them and their knowledge and their expertise and their areas as touch points. Hey, I'm thinking about doing this at Replenix. What do you think? They're owners, so they have an ownership share, and so getting their buy-in is important. But also, they're just great humans and they're good thinkers. And I think that all businesses, whether they're family-owned businesses or any other type of independent business, good thinking is critical to them.
I had a recent guest on who used to get that buy-in of outside family, who didn't have a stake just because, just because it was a close family, and he knew that they talked, and he knew that they talked business. So, maintaining that line of communication, even though he didn't have to, served him well.
My brothers have no vested interest other than my success. So, because there's no competition, they're able to see and listen to the business issue, independent of, oh, but I really like that person that we're talking about. I don't want to see anything bad happen to them. Or, oh, wow, I really like that person. Let's promote that person, and being blind to the training that that person needs or the additional leadership opportunities they need in order to be successful in the seat. I mean, it really, it's a huge privilege to have that kind of relationship with my brothers, and to have them know enough about the business to be curious, and have and the fact that they respect me enough to give me the space to do what I do. I mean, that's a blessing every
That's
day.
awesome. That's awesome. And I've noticed that as a recurring theme as well, is that even when there are family members that are ancillary, that are not directly involved or not operating involved, it would seem that great families and strong root families also lead to make great business,
Yes.
So that support structure is there. And it sounds like in your case, as with many others, you tap it when you need to, and it's there for you, and they're there for you. And
Almost every day on the way home.
they're That's terrific. That's terrific.
Hey, listen, the commute is good for a variety of things. And if I get to check in with the minority shareholders and see how their businesses are running, and then also bounce ideas off of them, arguably it's a huge win.
Awesome. Awesome. Now, you mentioned this earlier, and I want to come back to this.
Yeah.
The way that you entered the business was a little different, but when you were coming into it, your father had already moved into more of a chairman role, a
Yes.
strategic role. There was an operating president in place who was not a family member that was running the day-to-day. So,
Correct.
if you could, Matt, talk for a minute about that particular succession dynamic and how that was a little different, because in most of our guests, it's really more a bit more linear, where it's the next generation is stepping into the business and then ultimately succeeding in leadership. So your case, it was a little different.
Greatest gift ever.
Okay. How about that?
Well, aside from my brothers and my
Got
siblings,
it.
kids, my wife, from a business standpoint, because my dad was serving in that chairman role, his emotional, mental investment in anything that existed in the business was low. Therefore, as I was learning things through that general counsel window and becoming more active in other aspects of how the business was run, when I wanted to undo something or change something, It was more about a negotiation with an outside family member who was doing things the way that they had been doing things, but there was no conflict with my dad. And that ability to have no conflict with my dad because I was undoing something that he had done himself was really liberating. That structure saved countless hours of conflict. I mean, I obviously have a lot of friends who are in this space, not just industrial distribution, but in businesses that are owned by their families. And they've not had that similar story. They have not had that similar opportunity. And every step that they were taking towards ultimately becoming the president was, became my gain was my parent, my dad's loss. And we didn't have that. Every time I had a gain, my dad could be proud of me and happy for me that I was prepared to take on another level of responsibility without personally feeling a sense of loss or that I was pushing him out of the business. I'm not sure I can say that about the person who was the president at the time. I mean, I think that there was a little bit more of a challenge there in terms of I was taking on things that maybe he wasn't ready to give up, or I had a different perspective than he did. And if it was a tie, I usually won. But from a family and from a business standpoint, it was a huge blessing to not have my dad in the day-to-day and only looking at the strategic positioning of the business.
Well, whereas a lot of your journey and you've expressed a lot of gratitude to family for how they I'd say guided you. You ultimately did it, but they gave you some good guidance and some good runway and a good swim lane to get to where you got to. I imagine your timing could be have been a little better when you decided to step into leadership because it was 2008.
Okay, just so we're clear, I was a hero. Like for the first 8, 9 months of that year, revenue was cooking, margin was headed in the right direction. We were growing like gangbusters. And we actually finished 2008 really well. When the housing bubble burst and all the other things happened and with the stock market and everything else, I was actually on a supplier incentive trip out of the country, and I was just watching the market crash on BBC because it was the only English language television station. And I came back, and I was, a little anxious, a little uncertain, and I looked around. I kept watching the numbers. I kept talking to our customers. I kept everything. Nope, this explosion that happened was seemingly not, the ripple effect was not seemingly happening in our customer base until April 1st of 2009.
So what happened in April 1st of 2009?
Literally, I thought like it was an April Fool's joke. I was like, the phones aren't ringing, the emails aren't coming. Like, what's happening? It was literally like somebody shut the power off, turned the water off, however you want to say it. It was everything just stopped. And so, I'm now arguably a year into my presidency and didn't necessarily have a plan because when I came, when the market crashed, and I spent the 120 days, tracking and monitoring, and nothing was materially different in the business. Yeah, some of the daily sales were not where we normally would see them, but broadly speaking, everything was still moving, and everybody that I was talking to was still, pretty confident. And then it was just, I was like, wait, what just happened?
Well,
And then we had to roll up our sleeves.
so what did if you look back at that period, and for us it was 2008, and it was a scary year, right? That was a scary year for us. Seeing things that, being a younger version of me, like we were seeing like some of our clients' CEOs were being fired. And I remember thinking, I didn't know they could do that. But then I'm like, yeah, I guess they can. You know, it's an employee, right? They can fire them.
Yes.
So I'm like, wow, I've not seen this before. a scary time. But you plowed through that time. To talk about, as you look back, what did that crisis kind of give you some insight to as to who you are as a person under pressure?
I think, I was thinking about this just as we were, we had talked about it a little bit when we were just having our last conversation. I'm pretty good under pressure. And I've known that about myself for a long time. When the pressure is over, I'll get a migraine or I'll need to sleep for a while or, but in that actual moment, I'm just wired to kind of take everything down. And what I know is that no amount of schooling, training, or education teaches you how to manage a global recession. They don't teach you how to be a leader when everything around you is crumbling, not just within your business, but society was crumbling in many regards and in many areas. And it was really a test because, when everything's stable, it's easy to be a leader.
True.
But what I really learned is that having a great team is essential. My leadership team at the time, we all had very diverse backgrounds. It's part of why the leadership team we have today all come from very diverse backgrounds. I'm a big believer in that from a culture standpoint. And we made the right decisions, the decisions that that needed to be made quickly, we made quickly. And the decisions that we knew that we could kick down the road a little bit, we did. And finding that balance between what has to happen ASAP to keep the lights on or get the lights turned back on, and what can we take a wait and see approach with to make sure that we're not premature about cutting services, cutting people, making dramatic changes to the business structure. If we don't have to do that today, let's not. But let's know what markers we're looking for to know that we don't wait, 2 weeks too long. And it was that balanced approach, and it was going home and, taking a deep breath, spending a little time with my kids, being and really slowing things down. I spent the better part of 2 decades coaching youth skiing, like 6-year-olds. So, just get them up, get them going. But the coaching philosophy was always you have to slow down to speed up. How do you take your little skiers on the least amount of incline or grade to be able to master the skill that they need to master? Then take them to a steeper grade, so you go from a green hill to a blue hill to a black diamond. If you start on the black diamond, you're in trouble. But that whole slowing everything down and gaining mastery while you're moving slowly had a direct application to what we were doing. And anything that we could slow down, we did. And it was helpful.
As I look back in that period, so ours was, as I said, 2008, yours was the
Right.
2009. I think it was a hard year, but I think as a team, we weren't ever so tight as we were as a team because we truly bonded together and plowed through.
See, that was my COVID.
So I was going to say, they don't hand out a playbook for a global recession. They also don't hand out a playbook for a global pandemic. And you had said, gosh, after 2008, COVID was not as dramatically challenging as 08, 09.
Well, I mean, if back to what I was just saying, you can't take a class that teaches you how to deal with
Yeah.
a complete upheaval in your business. And but 2008 taught me that. And so even though I had a completely different leadership team by 2020, I was like, oh, we've done this. Not a global recession, and it's not that we did COVID perfectly. I don't know that there is such a thing, but the ability to take stock in what you had and how to deploy, what resources were available, it made it, I was like, okay, we got this. We've made it through something big like this, and we had five people in the office, all socially distanced by their cubes, all wearing the masks, because Minnesota was very regulated at the
Oh,
time. Then we
remember.
had everybody in the warehouse also materially socially distanced. Warehouse didn't come into the main part of the building, so that we are trying to keep two independent populations healthy. And but boy, did it bring that team close together. Because how do you get food? I mean, like, you can't go out for lunch, so because there's no but nothing open. And so Costco, as soon as Costco was open, Costco pizza became, we run out and go get, we have our masks on in the car and we drive over to Costco and we get our, and so every time now that there's a Costco pizza sitting in the break room, it brings back, yeah, we were tight and we got it all done. And then we were able to bring everybody back and we didn't lose any employees in a material way. We didn't lose our momentum in any kind of material way. But the tightness that we experienced, that was unbelievable.
And I think I can share that sentiment. And even with people that were hired during COVID, I recall one person on the team. I think we officially kind of came back. Was it 21, late 21 or 22? And shaking their hand, shaking his hand, and I'm thinking, this is the first time, and this person's been here for 2 years. This is the first time I've shaken their hand, and I'm like, that's weird.
I don't think we had that. I don't think we had anybody. I mean, we sent everybody home. I mean, you want to talk about, again, we had a financing relationship in place and we financed some equipment that we were sending to Canada. And the financer said, whoa, 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 whoa. You're not allowed under the financing agreements to send that product to Canada. So we had to do a really fast pivot, reset some financing. But we had all this money and we said, well, maybe we should get everybody laptops. The desktop computer systems are old. We're migrating to the cloud. There's all these other things going on. And actually, we were in the process at the beginning of 2020 of moving our whole ERP system to the cloud. And so we launched the last of the laptops with the VPN and all the stuff set up on them the week before Governor Walz said everything is shutting down, even for essential businesses. And so when we had to go to a skeleton staff, again, sometimes good luck is better than good planning. Everybody just went home and started up on their laptops. We had them come in shifts to pick up their screen so they could have the dual screen set up. And what was going to be 2 weeks at home turned into like 6 or 8 because of just how the shutdown here worked and how things kind of slowly came back online. And we were rotating people. There was a very slow comeback, if you will. Rotating people in and out of the office because we were being very cautious. We have employees who are high risk, so we're managing that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, nobody taught you how to manage a global pandemic, but the learnings of 2008, even with a different leadership team, that, hey, let's slow down, let's read the tea leaves, let's understand things, and then make a move forward, became important. And again, in the back of my head, this can't fail on my watch. I can't have this business go down while it's on my watch. Oh, I made it through 2028. I have to, or 2008. I have to do this. I mean, so there is a little bit of pressure, but it was easier because we'd done something before.
And imagine the next global calamity. Now those of us that have been through two,
Poo,
they're
poo,
like,
poo, poo, poo,
oh,
poo. No
whatever.
more global calamities. We're done. We need everything fixed on a global level, and we just need more calm, more peace. I don't know if I have it in me.
Well, you've done it twice now, so as have I.
Well, is
We
that
should do it
you, what are
again.
you saying? The third time's the charm?
I don't know. After
Oh.
I figure you get conditioned to this stuff after a while. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe not. Each one is different, though. So it always has that sky is falling feeling, right?
I want that on somebody else's watch.
Okay.
Like, you know, like let my kids or their spouse or, you know, let them manage that. It doesn't need to be out of my watch, Ed.
Understood. So, Replenix now, you're in your 80th year. And you've been fairly intentional about highlighting that, along with highlighting some longstanding supplier relationships as part of that story. Matt, why is that important to really put the spotlight on your supplier relationships as you celebrate this 80th year milestone?
We're a distributor. I mean, pure and simple. We are only as good as our employees and our supplier relationships. We don't make anything. And so, on that supplier side, to have supplier relationships that go back, I mean, the longest standing supplier relationship that we've been able to track goes back to just before I was born. And I know that because the supplier is, well, now goes by Dormer Promet, but at the time it was Dormer. Alex Dormer was the founder of Dormer, and they made high-speed steel drills and round tools. And I know that that's the longest relationship I can track to because when I was born, my uncle was apprenticing for Alex Dormer in England.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
And so that continuity of a relationship, partners who decade after decade after decade continued to show up with us, servicing the customer, making sure that we're bringing value. Finding ways to save them money, just like my grandfather did for the army. All of those things really create that longevity of a relationship. I mean, and when you can't get my words out, we have five employees who made Replenix their home for over 50 years. And when you think about disruption today and the rate at which it happens, the rate at which people move from business to business. We've got over five employees. It's actually, I think, over five employees who have had over 50 years of tenure at Replenix. We've got multiple customer relationships that are over 30 years old. And so highlighting that what we do with our suppliers is part of how all of that happens. And you know, today, it's crazy times. We get multiple price increase letters a week, multiple a day sometimes. 10, 20, one of them last week was 30%. Because of all the economic uncertainty that's going on and the challenges of getting raw materials, having those strong supplier relationships. Ultimately, and recognizing them as part of the legacy that we have built and continue to build those are the relationships that are going to allow us, despite those price increases, to bring value to the customer.
That's amazing.
What we sell may cost more or be priced higher, but here's how we're going to leverage that manufacturer's technology on the customer's production floor to minimize the impact of the price of the round tool, of the adhesive product, of the sandpaper or grinding wheel or whatever it is that is coming through. And maintaining those supplier relationships is important because it's important to the customers.
Yeah. And it's amazing that they've been so enduring across the board. It speaks very highly to the, you know, not just the team today, but all the teams that preceded the team today. They all, you know, had their turn at the wheel, and they all did great work, or else those relationships wouldn't be enduring as they are.
You know, and they ebb and flow. Just the other day, I had I was having a conversation with a supplier. We used to do an incredible amount of business with that supplier. And over time, that relationship just started to ebb. And we're now in a position where, based on our customers and who is working for that supplier in this region, we've got this great opportunity to cause that relationship to flow again. And so that whole recognition that life is dynamic. And I like dynamic versus disruptive. Because disruptive to me almost implies, you know, a permanent kind of break. And we are living in a disruptive society. I mean, there's no question about it. But when Replenix thinks about and talks about our supplier relationships, there is that recognition that they are dynamic because people are involved. And despite the advancements in generative AI and the way in which AI has integrated itself into the technologies that we use today, in the industrial space, we're still a person-to-person business. My predecessor used to say we're a belly-to-belly business. The ability to sit down with somebody and walk through a solution, there's an art to selling some of the things that we sell. There's an art to the application of how a grinding wheel or a cutting tool ultimately creates the finished product. And so recognizing that just because a relationship is currently on an ebb, that supplier may still have a great product that applies to a different customer that allows us to kind of grow the relationship back.
Nice.
And when you've got an 80-year history.
Speaking of that, turning 80, just imagine if say your great-grandfather could walk through the doors today and see what Replenix has become. What do you think might surprise him the most?
Okay, so this is an important distinction. My great-grandfather would look around and want to know why we're spending all this money. Generationally, you know, again, he ran his bakery through the Great Depression.
Yes, yes.
Every penny made a huge difference. He would be in disbelief, but he'd want to know why we're spending so much money. And it's not that we're spending so much money, it's just relative to how he grew. I mean, he and my dad shared an office.
Okay.
And not like a palatial kind of, you know, however big this office is. Like they shared an office desk to desk, and there was no other space. But my grandfather, I think, would look around, and his expression was always that he was so proud his buttons were bursting. So he would always say, you know, my buttons are bursting. I know that based on his desire to buy the right products and bring them to market with the right suppliers to bring value to the customer, his buttons would be bursting today.
Yeah.
He would look at the team that we have assembled here. He would look at the way in which we capitalized on his thought process of I could build a business by selling cost savings and bringing that to the market, and he would be really proud and amazed with all the technology. My grandfather was always curious.
I'll bet. I'll bet.
And so I think he'd love all that. And then a couple of the people who knew him are still here. So, I mean, there's a different kind of benefit that way.
Understood. Understood. So now looking forward to 27 and beyond, what do you think the next chapter of Replenix needs to stand for? What's next for you? What's next for Replenix?
We talk about actively, it's part of our purpose is to run a profitable business to make an impact in the lives of our employees, our customers, and the community at large. And we do that by creating reliable supply chains for our customers. Supply chains that deliver the right product at the right price to the right location and drive cost savings. I don't see a time where that isn't going to be relevant. That supply chain, just when we think that the supply chain has kind of normalized itself, there's a disruption because there's a global pandemic, because there aren't as many mining facilities and there's a shortage of carbide because all of the minerals that are used to create some of the abrasive products are now in short demand because there's people are willing to pay more for them to do some alternative thing. The global economy has created huge value and different sets of constraints in terms of getting the right products to the right customers, driving those savings. So I don't think that that value chain changes. What I do think starts to shift is how. And so Replenix is very focused today on if we're going to be profitable to reinvest in the business, our employees, and in our customers, how do we harness generative AI? How do we harness belly-to-belly activities? And how do we harness other technology to surround the customer in a way that meets them where they are for their needs to drive cost savings through their business? Not really different than when my grandfather found cost savings for the army.
And not
Like,
really different from how he remained as you remain today, naturally
right.
curious.
But harnessing, but the opportunity is different. Being curious
Of course.
about the ways in which we can do it. Ultimately, I think is where Replenix will continue to be focused, not just in 2026, but through the next through this generation for sure. How are we going to continue to be curious about the delivery of cost savings to ensure that the domestic manufacturing, and by domestic, Replenix is in the U.S. and Canada, so we've got facilities throughout the U.S. and in Canada. So that's my version of domestic. But how do we support domestic Canadian, domestic U.S. manufacturing to keep that going in the economy and keep our customers profitable?
Got it. Got
It's a little scary because, just in the course of this conversation, any AI tool that you want to use has already gotten smarter.
it.
Think about that. I mean, it's a little bit of a scary thought. In the period of
Yeah.
time we've been talking, AI has already gotten smarter.
Yeah.
And so how do you be curious enough to understand how to harness that intelligence in what is still a belly-to-belly world?
It is interesting times we live in for sure.
It's a great challenge to have. I mean, think about it.
It is, and when it's harnessed properly, it can be very powerful.
Well, arguably, the opportunities are limitless.
100%, absolutely. Last question for you. And this has been great. And I feel like, Matt, we could talk for hours and days. But if any of our listeners wanted to connect to learn more about you, your journey, or to learn more about Replenix, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn. Replenix is on LinkedIn. And then, we've got a great website, www.replenix.com. And there's links there to a variety of things that will help people understand what we do and how we do it.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, to wrap up, what certainly stands out in your story, Matt, is legacy is not inherited passively. It's protected, it's challenged, it's carried forward with a lot of intention. I really appreciate you sharing the Replenix story today and your perspective as the fourth generation leader, which in and of itself is remarkable, as you're navigating both the history and the future of Replenix. Again, we've been speaking with Matt Cohen, president of Replenix, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia. And this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Matt, thanks again for joining us today.
Ed, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.deleonet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at deleonet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.